Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to today's live Ruby event. I'm Chef Char Nolan, a member of the Culinary Instructional Team, and it's great to have everyone here today. We have some great questions, and I like to bring a little show and tell with me every week so that I can clear off my workspace a little bit. I do want to show you one thing that I absolutely love, and it's really, for me, an important thing to have because keeping a proper temp of food, especially when you are traveling or en route, is so important. And this is called a Wonder Bag. And a Wonder Bag is made in South Africa. It's insulated well. You put your pot or pan in here, and actually, you can finish cooking beans or whatever. The backstory is very rich and entertaining. If you take yourself to wonderbag.com, you can read all about the development of this wonderful project and how it helped to save and nourish communities in South Africa. I've had mine for about 5 years. I use it all of the time. A dear friend had a mother who was convalescing, and every week she took food to her mother in this, and it arrived perfectly warm and delicious. So Wonder Bag, look it up. Great item for traveling with food whose temp you want to maintain. Also, if you've got something cold, it will also keep the temperature for that. And that will work really well. So we're going to get right into our questions today because we have some really good questions. And this is from Diane Kay, who starts off asking about garlic and how, if it is overcooked, how it can become bitter. And if you are familiar with the no oil mushroom saute method, you see that the sequence is to first put the shallots in because that is a high water vegetable, followed by the garlic, which is a low water vegetable, and they can burn very, very quickly. So that would be the sequence, and then the mushrooms. But never, my Italian grandmother would cook, cloves and cloves of garlic in olive oil. And I think I seem to remember that sometimes the garlic was burned. If you go out to a restaurant sometimes and the food might taste bitter to you, it's probably because the garlic was overcooked. So know the heat of your pan, do the mercury ball test, and you should be well on your way to sauteing your garlic without having it burn and become bitter. So always an important question. You can check that assignment out if you haven't done it just yet, Diane, but for me, that assignment is a cornerstone of our program because it's such a great technique to learn, and it becomes a really good way to cook not just mushrooms, but zucchini and other kinds of vegetables, eggplant, another one that is certainly good and delicious, especially when it's sauteed. We talk a lot about pots and pans on all of the live events. And this is a question again from Diane Kay asking about carbon steel. So I do not own any carbon steel pots or pans. My pots and pans are very, very old. They're stainless steel. I have a couple of ceramic ones that I use when I teach on the Charlie cart because the Charlie cart uses an induction stove. And most of the newer carbon, ceramic pots and pans are good to use on an induction stovetop. However, for Christmas, friends gave me a caraway pan. And a caraway pan is a fancy schmancy ceramic pan. And it's also good for an induction stovetop. And I know people who actually make their pancakes in this pan without using oil. The funny thing about this pot or pan is that it came with its own cleaner. And this thing feels like something you would use to clean your face because it's very soft and gentle. So I think that if you do invest in any high grade, and this is a very high grade ceramic pan, that the care of it is what sustains its use for a very, very long time. So I just wanted to quickly show that to you. I'm not sure if I can answer the question. They seem to be quite the rage right now. I don't know if you need them. Some of my stainless steel pans that I do use have come from a thrift shop. So if you're unsure about how to work with stainless steel, head to a thrift shop, look for some Revere, for some Farberware, from some very popular pots from the 50s and the 60s that have sustained themselves and still work very, very well. I don't think that you need to go and spend a lot of money on a good pan. Start out at a thrift shop, and I'm sure you'll be able to find some good stainless steel. Stainless steel is my preference always. So that was another very, very good question. excuse me. This is from Janet B. She was asking about the convection setting on her oven. So I have an old oven. I don't have a convection setting to it, but I have an air fryer, and an air fryer is essentially a convection oven, only a much more miniature scale. And what is it good for? If I had a convection oven, I would use it to roast vegetables, because I think that the circulating air would help to make them crispier and would give them that finish and color that you look for when you're caramelizing vegetables while roasting them. I don't know if I would bake with it. I checked with one of my friends last night. She uses her convection setting for vegetables and baked potatoes and such. But in terms of baking, she uses the oven setting, the conventional oven setting, shall we say. In terms of using your air fryer, I roast potatoes in my air fryer because they come out super crispy on the outside and very, very moist on the inside. So essentially, in a quick nutshell, that is the difference. And maybe someday I will have a convection oven. My oven is not that old, so we like to hold on to things in our household. So that was a great question. Thank you so much, Janet, for asking that, because I do get that question a lot on assignments. And I think for the roasting assignment where you roast your vegetables, using the convection oven might be a good tool. And mention that in your final, in the final portion of your write-up, that you use the convection oven, and talk about some of the differences that you may have noticed while cooking them that way. Very good question. So the next question is from Chef Fran. And Chef Fran and I happen to shop at the same grocery store, only in different locations. And it's very funny, Fran, that you wrote this question about kale, because last night when I was getting ready to saute some dino kale, it seemed a little tough to me. So what I did, and I don't usually do this when I cook kale, but I massaged it first. And after I washed it, I usually dry the excess water off, but I thought a little extra moisture in the pan would help it. So massage, and after you wash it, don't bother drying it, because the kale needs a little bit extra moisture at that time. I also noticed that the leaves of the dino these last 2 weeks have been huge and gigantic, whereas I'm used to seeing them smaller and petite, where they're a little bit more tender. So I think that the size of the kale leaf might also have something to do with that. But hail to kale, power to kale. We love our kale, and making it soft and tender is the best and most enjoyable way to eat it. So very good question. One of these days, Fran, I'll see you at Mom's and we'll give a big hug to one another. This question is, Fran has piped in, which I always appreciate, and she is saying yes to baking on convection bake. She's telling you to cut the temperature back 25 degrees Fahrenheit to start. So Fran is an experienced baker. My friend isn't a baker, so I would listen to Fran over my friend, but thanks for that input, Fran. Very much appreciated. That's good to know. Anita, I love this question so much, because Anita has written about she's tried to use her mother's old rolling pin. So this is the 75-year-old rolling pin of my mother. And I believe these used to be red, and this one is missing. And it's got nicks and dents and such in it. And I saw on your question that your father oiled it with some cooking oil. So here is my recommendation. You can wash this with warm water and a very mild detergent, and then dry it really well. And if you want to, you can put some mineral oil on it, like just a dab, just to get it, if you want to get it moisturized. I have never put mineral oil or anything on this, and it looks like it has sustained itself over those years. One of the things that I do use is I use a rolling pin cover so that if I am rolling out a dough, it allows me to roll the dough a little bit thinner. And with that, I find that the dough is a little bit flakier. So keep it clean. Enjoy using it. I hope that your rolling pin is filled with fond memories. Every time I take this out of the cabinet, I always think of my mom, who was a great baker. And I feel really lucky to have this. It's a nice piece, nice memory to have of my mom. This is from Dan Merrick. Oh gosh, Dan, I can't get up and go to the other side of the kitchen, okay? But Dan and a couple of the Fran and Eric and I, we always send each other recipes or new hacks that we have tried out. And I will post this on the Instagram at Ruby Plants so that you can see it. But you take a pound of garbanzo beans and you soak them in water for 12 to 18 hours. And the person who wrote this recipe was very specific about the beans soaking for that long. And then you rinse them and drain them, and you spread them on a baking sheet. And then you pour a couple of tablespoons of baking soda or sodium bicarbonate over them, and you bake them for 10 minutes in a 350 degree Fahrenheit oven. And then after that, you boil them in water. You cover, you put the beans in a pan, you cover them, and then you boil them, and you constantly remove the scum, lack of a better word, I should say foam. And then when the beans are finished making, they are tender and beautiful. I can't even explain it to you. Then you make your hummus, and rather than your hummus being grainy and yellow, it's almost a beautiful, fluffy white. And it is the most beautiful and delicious hummus I have ever made. And I will tell you that from that 1 pound bag of garbanzo beans, it made 3 pounds of hummus. Now that is a lot of hummus, but I have an event tomorrow, so I'll be able to use the hummus. But I think the trick in using the sodium bicarb and roasting them for 10 minutes in the oven is what I noticed to be the changing factor. So I'll put the hummus up on our at Ruby Plants. And by the way, for those of you who are in, I believe it's Mineral Point, Wisconsin, Dan will be doing a live event there. So if you are in that area, hop in your car and go say hi to Dan. And seeing Dan in action is always a pleasure. So thanks for your good question, Dan. I really appreciated that. Another great question. This one comes from Shonda. Shonda wants to know the ratio of using fresh versus using dried. So here is 3 tablespoons of cilantro. I use a lot of cilantro in my house. And here is its equivalent in dry form, which would be 1 tablespoon. So it's 3 to 1. That's the general rule of thumb that I would go by for especially things like dill, parsley, cilantro. There are other specific ones for, you know, using coriander seeds versus using a powder, etc. But for the greens, it's 3 to 1. When they are dehydrated, you lose about 2/3 of the liquid. So my own preference is, and maybe next time we do a live event, I'll show you what I do to keep my greens fresh in the freezer so that when I am making something, it has a little bit better flavor. And we all know that any leafy green, if not preserved properly in the refrigerator, can look like a science experiment. So I'll show you the trick, I promise, next time. That will be great. Taught to me by Margaret Kuo, who is a very famous chef here in Philadelphia. So, Shonda, that's a great question. The other thing I recommend is that when you do buy dry herbs, take a Sharpie marker, write your purchase date on the bottom, you know, 424, because sometimes we lose track of them. And then using an old spice can have an impact on the final flavor of a dish. Fresh is always better. Great question. Thank you so much. I appreciate that. This is from Melissa B. What type of cutting board do I recommend in a plant-based kitchen? So that could be an entire AMA about cutting boards, but I will tell you what I do and what works for me. So I have several. I have some that are made from maple, which I absolutely love. And I clean them with lemon juice and salt so that they stay clean and fresh, and the lemon juice sort of acts as an antimicrobial. But for every day, I have this gray plastic thing that I love because you can swish the vegetables out. I'm going to have to get a new one soon because there are a lot of grooves. But what I do is on the back, I have written onions so that I use this side just for chopping onions and this side just for chopping strawberries or lettuce or whatever, because there's nothing worse than buying a box of strawberries and having them taste like onions. So you should have a designated chopping board for things like garlic and onions and other fragrant vegetables, like for other items like leek as well. So that's my recommendation. Keep them clean. I put this in the dishwasher sometimes, depends, you know, how busy I am for that day. But there are some other sources. You know, you can use wood, you can use plastic, you can use bamboo. It depends exactly what you're looking for. They all have a purpose. And I have to say that I think I have every one of those woods that I just named, but something like this is totally a favorite. And on the Charlie cart, we use a flexible cutting board, and on the Charlie cart, they have them designated in their color of purpose. So though we don't use meat on my Charlie cart, red would be for meat, blue for seafood, yellow for bread, and green for vegetables. But we use all of them for vegetables. So just a little point of interest. So I hope that's helpful. I'm always curious to hear what other people use in their kitchens, but I have a lot of cutting boards and I love them all equally as much. So Melissa wants to know what size I prefer. So if you can see where my finger is right now, this is a plexiglass cutting board that I have over the counter, and it is 18 by 36, and it's gigantic. And I keep it here because I want protection for my countertops, but it also works really well. It's not my favorite. I really do enjoy something of this size. And I'm going to say that this is probably 14 by 10 or 12. And that fits well. The other thing is that I'm on the road a lot teaching cooking classes. And I have to think in very pragmatic ways of how I'm going to transport things. So this fits very well into my little wagon or my little suitcase that I travel with. So if you're making dinner for, you know, 2, 4, or 6 people, this should be absolutely fine for you. Something too big, I often hear from older adults who will buy a beautiful, big, gigantic cutting board, and it becomes too much of a monstrosity to lift and clean. So there are some other variables to also think about. So if you see a sale on a cutting board and it's not, exorbitantly expensive, you might want to pick it up and see if you like it, because sometimes you like to cut different things on different cutting boards. And I think that somebody in that same question about cutting boards had asked about knives. And you always hear me talk about these beautiful Victronic knives that we use on the Charlie cart, and I love them so much. It's a small serrated knife. They also come in a paring knife. Oh, you can see it perfectly against my shirt. I love these knives because they cut beautifully. They will leave a mark on your cutting board. And then for my everyday big chops, I have a, this is a Cutco knife, and I absolutely love it, and I take very good care of it. And I don't remember how much it was, but the guy at the, I was at a flower show, and the Cutco guy was there, and everybody was like, oh, you need a Cutco knife. And at first I was skeptical, but I like it very, very much. But my everyday knife that you always see me use will be these, because I just love how they cut. They're easy to clean. They don't take up a lot of space. So they do sell them at the Big A, but you can also go to the Swiss Army Knife website and you can see the knives there. Oh, gee, Dan. Dan is asking like a question that might make me cry. Can you tell us a favorite family recipe that you used to enjoy before going plant-based that I have converted to whole food plant-based? So last week I taught a live cooking class in person at the Mainline School Night, where I'm a member of the culinary staff. And I made what is called penne gotta, not panicata, but penne gotta. And it is what my grandmother called bread soup. So it is a big, gigantic bread soup, and then you take stale bread and you cover it with the bread, and then the bread gets soggy so that when you eat the soup, you get full quickly. And my grandmother would serve it a lot during the Great Depression of 1929. And we can I can remember my parents saying, oh, Mom, I wish you would make some penne gotta. And she would say, no, that dish has bad memories for me. So penne gotta. But Dan, I have to tell you that I have been able to convert the majority of every single recipe of my grandmother, from making an almond ricotta, to making lasagna, to making manicotta, and all kinds of things. You have to remember that my grandparents were from the southern part of Italy, which is largely agricultural. So growing up, we did not eat a lot of meat and fish and other types of meat. So vegetables are what I grew up with. And we always ate our vegetables first so that we would get full on our vegetables. And just like Jeff Novick and everyone else shows you that diagram of 400 calories of vegetables and your stomach and how filling that is. So the hardest thing to recreate, though, would be desserts, because a lot of them are based in lots of oil and lots of sugar and other things like that. But I'll send you a recipe card, because I had a great recipe card made for the penne gotta to hand out to the students. But soups and pasta, you can never go wrong. That's a great question. Thank you so much. There. Oh, yeah. Send me an email and I will send you that recipe. My email at Ruby is char, C-H-A-R, at Ruby, R-O-U-X-B-E.com. This is from Kathy C. Hello, Kathy. I know that you eat no SOS. How do you make food such as cookies without any sugar at all? The correct term would be refined sugar. So I will use maple syrup, which has some nutrient density to it, or I will use dates, which are also very nutrient dense. They contain calcium. They're a good source of potassium. But in terms of using a refined white, even if it's vegan sugar, I never, ever use that. So I made, last week I sent Chef Eric a recipe and I said, I'm going to try this. And the recipe was this. The recipe was 4 apples, and you peel them, cube them, and boil them. And then you take you take some chocolate bars, and I used an 85% chocolate bar, which is not very sweet. And what happens is that it makes a beautiful cheesecake. So when you look at it, there was some sugar in the chocolate, but it wasn't 1.5 cups of granulated sugar. And if I did have that dessert, which I'll be serving tomorrow, I might enjoy a little teeny weeny bite. And if you want to, email me and I will send you a picture of what the final dessert looks like, because it looks like something that would be filled with all kinds of sugar and fats and everything else. And the pectin from the apple made this cake just have the most beautiful texture. So if I make cookies, it is bananas, oats, and raisins, and boom, the cookies are done. So, and everybody seems to love those three ingredient cookies, which are wildly popular. You can add a nut butter to it if you wish. How do I sharpen my knives regularly? Do I use a whetstone, etc., another type of sharpener? I have a whetstone on my windowsill because it is the same size as a windowsill and it's very long. And I do prefer a whetstone because that lesson in Ruby is a great teaching lesson. And I also have a knife sharpener that I use occasionally, but the whetstone is what I use to sharpen my knives. The serrated knives I don't sharpen. At my farmer's market, there's a knife sharpener, and I will take these there. And every 6 months, I take this to the knife sharpener man on the back of his truck. And he is very, very good about sharpening my knives. So this is, let's see where we're going now. Fran helped us out with that convection question, which was great. And I'm just perusing these. Not all of us do Instagram. If we email you, could you send us the recipe for the hummus? Absolutely. Char, C-H-A-R, at Ruby, R-O-U-X-B-E.com. The recipe that I will be sending you will have two attachments to it. One will be the video from the chef who made it. And then the other one will be a video of my finished product that shows you the creamy texture of it. And for anybody who has been to Philadelphia and has visited the Zahav restaurant, it is very similar to the texture of the Zahav hummus, except I do not put any oil in it on the top. Maybe a little sprinkle of some smoked paprika would be what I would do, but it was absolutely totally, totally incredible. I loved it very, very much. And okay, so it looks like we're almost near the end. I did want to talk about one more thing that students will often write in their summaries, and it is about proper temps for your food. And so I have one thermometer, that food thermometer that I keep in the sleeve of my chef coat. And then I have this laser one that still does the trick, but transferring your food, if you're catering or if you're teaching a class or for whatever reason, you always really want to know the temp of your food to make sure that it is ready for service and that it will remain super healthy for you. My closing comment is, and I always answer my email, my closing comment is that with it being not just yesterday being Earth Day, but it also being Earth Month, some of you may know that we have a fabulous course called Waste Not in affiliation with the James Beard Foundation. The course is free, and it is a nice way to keep your feet in the Ruby waters, so to speak. But what you will learn in this course is just so eye-opening, and it may change the way that you think in your own kitchen. It will also change the way that you think in a commercial kitchen or if you're doing private catering or teaching classes or whatever. So with that said, we are almost at 2:27 p.m. in the city of Brotherly Love. Always very, very nice to be here with you. Send me your questions and your emails at char@ruby.com. I wish everyone a great Wednesday. Oh, it's Tuesday. Have a great Wednesday, too. And thank you so much for tuning in. It was really a pleasure, and I look forward to seeing you in your assignments. So have a great day, everyone. Signing off from the city of brotherly love and sisterly affection. I'm Char Nold. Bye-bye now.